We call it Sippy STEM. So we're delighted to be here today. And the intent of this project for us is simple, and yet we can understand that it's complex. The grant is designed really to both engage with and encourage community colleges across the nation to think about the National Science Foundation's Advanced Technological Education Program and the ways in which it can help to not just transform institutions and have institutions have the ability to create some innovative programs, but it's also a clarion call to the nation's community colleges to think about our programming through the acquisition of grants that can help us meet the workforce needs in the skilled technical areas across the country. So we know that there are probably now about 1.6 million vacancies. And we believe that given the role that community colleges have played for more than 100 years, if you go back to the very first community college, that we have both the resources, and we're certainly more than serving the students who could become a part of that skilled technical workforce and also help us in terms of diversifying the workforce. So we have today seven regions where we cover. If you go to our ccpi-stem.org website, you'll see this map, and the map really lays out in some of the colors where our regions exist. They exist in the Northeast, Three Rivers, the Southeast. They exist in the Michigan, Ohio areas. Then we go to Oklahoma, Texas, Louisiana. We're also in Arizona, New Mexico, Southern California, Northern California, and we also look at some of the U.S. Territories, Puerto Rico, and the like. So there are a number of opportunities for all of you and your institution to become involved in the work that we do. And we encourage you to go to the website. You can hover over the colored locations that represent the states and some of the territories, and it will indicate to you who the regional network chairs are for those areas and give you the opportunity through the website to send an email in order to connect. So we're happy to have you with us today. And as we share some information about the institutions where we've had the privilege of working and serving students in our community, we'll also be able to talk to you about some of the mentor programs that currently exist through the National Science Foundation to really help the nation's community colleges, again, understand just the transformative power of grants as we continue to meet our local, regional, state, and national needs. And Beth, I'll turn it over to you to talk about some of these mentoring programs that are listed.
Sure. Thank you very much. As Dr. Dukes mentioned, there are these five different mentoring initiatives that are available to community colleges to help them craft their idea, as well as develop a competitive proposal to submit to the ATE program solicitation of the National Science Foundation. The first two that are listed, I'm sorry, the Force ATE and Mentor Up have due dates in the spring. I believe both of them, the applications are due April 1st. Mentor Connect, Pathways to Innovation, and Project Vision, I believe their application deadlines were in the fall, but look for them coming in fall 2024. But if you're interested in getting into either Force ATE or Mentor Up, those applications are due in the spring, I believe April 1st. We will share these slides with you, and these links are clickable, and it'll take you to the webpage of each of these mentoring initiatives where you can learn more and apply. Okay,
And really,
next.
Beth, if we could, they're really designed to help institutions, small teams who are either interested in developing grants, may not have done it before, they assign a mentor. So each program has its own specific criteria and information about what it is they do as institutions are interested in moving forward.
Thank you very much. I think this one is yours, Dr.
Yes,
Dukes.
It is. And, you know, we're happy to welcome all of you because the webinar today is really designed for minority serving institutions as defined by the United States Department of Education. And you know that that term is defined in the Higher Education Act, an act that has been with us since the early 1960s. And it really determines a lot of the things that we can do within higher education, post-secondary education. And, you know, there is a couple of definitions, and we want to make sure that you understand that we are talking about the MSI definition, not the Minority Science and Engineering Improvement Program and other programs whose statutes or regulations reference the same minority institution definition. For us, it's an institution of higher education whose enrollment of a single entity or population defined as minority or a combination of minorities exceeds 50% of the total enrollment. And quite frankly, there are probably a little over 700 or close, excuse me, to 800 community colleges across the United States that hold this definition as a minority serving institution. If we'll go to the next slide. And we know what those categories are. We have historically Black colleges or universities named and the acronym HBCU. And you should know that there are about 13, I think there are either 13 or 16 community colleges that are defined as HBCUs. So they are part of that body of institutions that we would really recognize as Miles College or Philander Smith or Howard University, Hampton University, Johnson C. Smith University are four-year institutions. But again, we have somewhere between 13 and 16 community colleges that also carry the HBCU acronym. We have our Hispanic serving institutions, our HSIs, our tribal colleges or universities, TCUs, our Alaska Native serving institution, or our Native Hawaiian serving institution, our predominantly Black institutions. And when I was president at Prince George's Community College, we were a predominantly Black institution. And we'll talk a little bit about demographics a little later in the presentation. And I understand over the last several years, Prince George's has become an MSI, which means that they're serving multiple minority populations of students and meeting that threshold that the Department of Education has set. We have our Asian American, Native American, Pacific Islander institutions, and certainly our Native American serving, but they're non-tribal institutions. So you all know all of these definitions, and I'm certainly sure that in your institutions, you also understand that these designations also allow you to apply for some funds that are not readily available to predominantly white institutions or the like. So next slide, please. So there are some stats, and I've already said some of this. Predominantly Black institutions, when we talk about the designation, it means at least 40% of the institution's total enrollment identifies as African American or Black. With Hispanic serving, it's 25% who identify as Hispanic or Latina. Asian American, Native American, Pacific Islander is at least 10%. Alaska Native, Native Hawaiian serving have to be at least 20%. And again, as we said, approximately 46% of all MSIs or two-year institutions or minority serving community colleges. And as we said before, many of you know this because you're working in these institutions with these designations, but you will be able to go back within a week or so and go to our website, and this presentation will be there and you're able to click on it and you know, review this information as you continue to move forward in your own community colleges. Next slide. And there is an available list, and these links too will be clickable when you go to the website. But the Office of Inclusive Excellence, it's interactive, it's a searchable website. And then, of course, through the Rutgers Graduate School of Education, there is a center for MSIs. They're all listed, and it gives some demographic information about the institutions, PDF documents that you cannot just click on, but you can also download for your own information and edification. Next slide, please. And there are a number of articles that exist. I think, Beth, this might be your slide. Am I correct?
Yes, yes. I'll be glad to talk about these articles that we found. And there's a long list of articles. We just picked out a handful that were most recent. There's such a growing body of knowledge out there on the research for minority serving institutions, and in particular, how they are helping to fill the STEM workforce gap. So just let me go through these quickly. So some of the questions that we are going to be discussing come from this first article, Serving Racial Minority Students in STEM at Minority Serving Community Colleges. And this was published out of the Office of Community College Research and Leadership out of the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. There is another office, another community college research center out of Columbia University, and they also do a lot of good research. So these are the two prime places, along with the American Association for Community Colleges, where you can get a lot of good information on minority serving institutions with regard to STEM education. The next one may not apply to all community colleges. Equity or disparity, do performance funding policies disadvantage two-year minority serving institutions? I know some community colleges are performance-based and some are not, so it may not apply. The third one, Latino access to community colleges and Hispanic serving institutions, a national study. This one is a little bit old, 2010, but it provides a lot of historical data and knowledge. And then the last one, Meaning Making About Becoming a Minority Serving Institution, a case study of Asian American serving community colleges. And this is from 2019 in the Review of Higher Education. And again, as Dr. Duke said, these slides will be available. Actually, I'll post the slides right after the SIPPYCast concludes, so you'll have access to the slides right away, and the video will take a week or more, as Dr. Duke said. And again, the PDF documents are clickable and available to you. Okay.
Back
to you, Dr. Duke.
Right, and if I could, one of the things that we've known for some time, and particularly for those of us who are members of the American Association of Community Colleges, who has a lot of data on their website. You can go to the National Clearinghouse. There's a lot of data. But we know that the nation's community colleges have grown in numbers in terms of our service to historically underrepresented populations in higher education. And we know that those are the very students that we've been talking about as we've been explaining the definitions of minority serving institutions. And one of the things that we want to do, and Scott also Brooks, Dr. also Brooks, we're from East Mississippi Community College. We're really delighted that you joined us today. And what we'd like to do is for the three of us to talk and briefly describe our institutions or as they were when we were employed there. We know that you are a current president, so your information may be much more current than Dr. Hawthorne and I might have. But talk to us about East Mississippi Community College, the demographics, who you serve, and how some of that has certainly spurred the work that you're doing.
Well, glad to. Thank you for having me, Dr. Dukes, and it's a privilege to be amongst this group today and to talk about EMCC and what's going on at NSF. And just to briefly describe EMCC, EMCC is an MSI. We are about 50-50 in our demographics with African-Americans and whites. And we're also a member of the PBI caucus and the predominantly Black institution effort. And, you know, those are big looks at data that we know. It's really easy to look at our demographics, but what does that really mean? And for us, and that's something we've been working on, we joined the Achieving the Dream Network a couple of years ago to really look deep into our data. And this data, and I'll talk to you about some of this, this data really describes what that really means. And I'm going to give you a good example. They met on this morning, actually. It's really relevant to what's going on. But there's a 27% gap in our success rate between white males and black males in college algebra. Now, obviously, if we want to get minorities, if we want to get black males into STEM programs, we've got to be better at preparing them in college algebra. And so we're really doing a deep dive into our data. And it's not just college algebra, it's across the board. You know, we see similar disparities in general biology and other STEM related fields and English composition. You see similar disparities. You know, what can we do better as an institution? What can we do from a teaching and learning standpoint to better prepare the minority students to go into STEM programs? Because you can't, it's very difficult to be proficient in a STEM program if you're not very good at math. We've got to get your math skills up. And if it's a scientific-based program, an earth science or whatever, you got to be good in biology. So those kind of areas, we have to really step it up for those areas. And so we're really looking into what can we do as an institution to do a better job in the classroom of working with our minority students and get closing that gap. We want everybody to perform at a higher level, but really we see some low-hanging fruit. So at EMCC, we're really working hard to close that gap in these STEM areas and other areas so that we can then, you know, like you said earlier, Dr. Dukes, I think it was you that said it, there's a large amount of job openings in STEM fields in this country. And we feel like we're failing our citizens. And we're very lucky at East Mississippi. We've been very fortunate in this general area to land some very large advanced manufacturing economic development projects. We just landed the biggest economic development project in the state of Mississippi about 4 months ago. It's an aluminum mill that's going to mill aluminum from recycled aluminum scrap. They're going to hire over 900 people, and all these people are going to have some technical expertise or technical ability. And the average salary at this place is going to be $93,000. The average salary. So Mississippi, you know, I don't know, some of you probably live in some big cities. That'd be like making $193,000 in a big city because our cost of living is really reasonable in Mississippi. So we really are working hard and really prompted by some of these great projects to help. We want to get these people out of poverty. And this is one way we can do that is to better prepare them in the classroom and get them into these STEM occupations that don't require a four-year degree. As you all know, these technician jobs that are out there, you know, you can get a really handsome job with a one-year degree from a community college and even a better job with a two-year degree from a community college. So we're doing a deep dive in our data to see how we can do a better job, better work to help our students and lift them, not only in the classroom, but this is life-changing salaries for these people. Lift them up out of poverty in the lower ranks of the socioeconomic spectrum into some of these great paying jobs. So that's kind of where we are at EMCC in regards to our general overview of STEM and what we're doing our work with our minority serving background and there's other things going on, but I'll pass the mic now to you, Charlene, and I'll chime back in when we hit on something else.
Okay, thank you, and thank you for that. Beth, why don't you talk to us a little bit about Union County?
I'd be glad to. So Union County is located, Union College of Union County is our new name, and the college is located in Northeast New Jersey, about a 20-minute train ride out of New York City, with three campuses, one suburban in Cranford, New Jersey, and two urban, one in Elizabeth, New Jersey, where you can catch the train and be in Penn Station in 15 minutes. And then the other one in Plainfield, New Jersey, which is a little bit further west in New Jersey. So when I was there, Union College was a Hispanic serving institution. We earned that federal designation. We also had one of the largest English language institutes, and we had 43 different languages that were spoken at Union County College. So being so close to New York City, you know, they say New York City is the melting pot. And we saw that splash over the Hudson River into New Jersey at Union County College. We also, I don't know the stats, but we also had a large population of African Americans also at Union County College when I was there.
All right, and then I'll share that when I was at Prince George's Community College from 1995 until 2020, we when I first started at PGCC, we were a predominantly white institution, and over time, as the District of Columbia changed, all of these sort of surrounding states. Because we call ourselves the DMV, and that's not the Department of Motor Vehicles, but it's the District of Columbia, Maryland, and Virginia. And as gentrification occurred in Washington, D.C., and people started moving out of the district in order to really find housing that was affordable and the like, Prince George's County slowly changed its mix of population. And the institution did as well, and we became a predominantly Black institution. At its highest when I was there, we were probably about 90% percent of the students identified as Black or African American, even if they were second generation from the Caribbean or the continent of Africa. And probably about 15% identified as Hispanic Latina. And what we found, of course, is that that meant that we needed to rethink a lot of things in terms of what our partnership was with the local public school system and what program mix that we had, how we were looking at our, at the time, developmental coursework. And then over time, how we began to engage not just in achieving the dream, but creating pathways for students so that we could ensure that they weren't leaving Prince George's Community College with actually more college credits than they needed because they were making their own decisions with regard to self-advising and the like. So we really changed our entire structure in order to support students and student success. It also gave us the opportunity to apply for some other grants that I mentioned earlier that were only available to students who were identified as predominantly Black or as we use the term today, minority serving institutions. We've always had a pretty, probably for about 40 years, a great relationship with the National Science Foundation. The first grant having been written by the STEM area and to this day, so that we've been able to really focus on students, their interest in STEM, and then with the public schools, creating a number of what we called early college programs that were focused on STEM, whether it was in the healthcare area, in computer science, cybersecurity, and the like. So much like you, Scott, we had to begin to look at what the success rates of students were and to determine what that is by virtue of race, ethnicity, even male and female. And then where we needed to really focus on some additional support services or expanding the support services that we had to focus on student success. We also looked at things from a regional perspective. You know, Prince George's County shares a border with the District of Columbia and with the state of Virginia. So we knew that within an hour's drive, our students could actually work anywhere. So in looking at our program mix, we took into account too that it was not just about the state of Maryland, but it was also about the region, including the District of Columbia and Virginia. So, you know, and if we go to our next questions, you know, maybe, and we'll start with you, Beth, do you think that minority serving institutions face greater challenges in preparing successful NSF ATE grant proposals and why?
You know, that's a very good question. And in my work as the principal investigator of FORCE, one of the mentoring initiatives, I'm not sure that they do. I think that community colleges who do not have the infrastructure or do not have a deep bench in the faculty in order to write a grant and then execute the grant. So I don't think that it's really unique to MSIs. I think we're seeing the barriers are really maybe lack of a grants office if you're a small and rural college, maybe administration, upper administration is not prioritizing grants, so that maybe if a faculty member has an idea for a grant, but it's not in the culture of that community college to do so. So I don't think there's greater challenges. I think just because they have the designation of an MSI, I think there are other characteristics that create those challenges, as I listed before.
Thanks. Thanks for that. And Scott, from your perspective, and certainly as a current president, how would you answer this same question?
I agree fully. I don't think it's the MSI part, statistic is what is the bigger challenge. I think community colleges in general, we have a big challenge. You know, our faculty, I describe them like this. They're very good at hands-on. They really like to apply themselves. But trying to get them into a grant writing mode is a bit of a challenge. That's not something that a lot of them have ever done. And it's a little bit of a challenge to get them to want to write grants. And that's why it's so important. We're a member of Project Vision. And we're probably going to join another one of the mentoring groups as well that's really helped some of our faculty overcome that. And we were able to write a successful proposal that was awarded right during COVID. And actually, one of the PIs that was one of our faculty members that agreed to do it passed away with COVID. So we ended up not pursuing that. But we got money. We ended up turning it away. Imagine that. But we weren't prepared because one of our faculty members that had really embraced this, that passed away with COVID. He was our PI. But now we're back with Project Vision again, and we're preparing some other faculty members. And I think that's the biggest hurdle. MSI or no MSI is having technical-oriented faculty that teach two-year degrees that really embrace writing grants and want to be a grant writer. And I think that's where that, like I said, the mentoring to help them learn that skill. That's not a skill that's typical with a technology or technician, technical faculty member. So I think that's probably our biggest challenge in the community college world.
And you know what I think about in my role, and I can recall when probably at our highest at Prince George's, the enrollment was 44,000 students. And what I always saw as a challenge was, how do we give faculty the kind of time that they needed in order to write grants and then execute them? Many of you are, all of you are aware that community colleges, we pride ourselves on being teaching institutions, which means that our faculty, for the most part, are teaching 15 credits a semester, which is full time, and then understanding the commitment of faculty who really are working on the development of grants and the execution of them outside of their classroom responsibilities and the like. And so for me as a president, one of the things that I always lamented is I could not figure out what that formula ought to be that would support both teaching, advising students, serving as mentors to students, and being able to write and successfully write grants, and then, of course, continue on to successfully implement them. That was always, for me, a conundrum as a college president. So I do agree that the challenges aren't greater, but that there might be, because of our funding models and the like, and our reliance on student tuition and fees, county support, state support, might not give us the same level of resources as other institutions. And we have to be very clear about what our priorities were.
You know, Charlene, that's a great point you make, too. And I'll say this, you know, we're a small rural college. We're only 3,500 students. And some of these technical programs that are very important to our college and to our industries that we support, they may only be one instructor. They teach the whole program. So if we remove them, if we give them some course releases to actually get involved with grant writing, then there's nobody else to actually do the teaching. You know, and it's hard to find adjuncts. It's a little easier on the academic side to find an adjunct to teach an English course for you or some of these kind of things, but it's tougher to go find somebody to teach a robotics course or a, you know, a fluid power course. It's a little more challenging to find that. So I think you're right. That's inherent to the community college world.
Exactly. Thank you for that. And, you know, that's why one of the cornerstones of SIPPI STEM is that we engage with presidents as well, to have presidents both continue or begin to think about where we can lean in with the resources that we have in order to support faculty and grants offices and the like, as we continue to understand how the use of grants and the availability of grants can help with not program expansion, can help with program creation, can also help with meeting the workforce needs of the local, state, and regional business and industry. So, you know, the other thing I thought was interesting in a discussion is most of the time we think that we have to do these things by ourselves. We have to think about how do we approach the opportunity to understand where the grants are, whether they're in the Department of Education, the Department of Commerce, the Department of Labor, the National Science Foundation, and the like, and that we somehow have to figure it out all on our own. So I'd like you all to talk about how you participated with other colleges and consortiums or other types of institutions, our four-year partners, and maybe share one or two outcomes that made that partnership worthwhile. We've talked about if you only have a one-person grants office, or you only have one faculty member who's doing all the teaching for a program, but also understand that there are some things out there financially that could support the work that's being done. Where did you see partnerships with other institutions as critical and essential to your work? So let's see, Scott, do you want to start with that? And then Beth will come to you.
I would be glad to. I think we've had some success in Mississippi with some, matter of fact, we're a member of the Northeast Mississippi Corridor Consortium, which is, you know, started as four community colleges. And now I think there's five of us in there that really, when there's a Toyota manufacturing plant that landed in Northeast Mississippi several years ago. And we all teamed together, all colleges teamed together to build the programs because they're really a regional employer. The people will drive, you know, an hour, which in Mississippi, that'll be 75 miles. They'll drive 75 miles, you know, one way to work. So that affects the several community college districts, and it's a real regional approach. And we successfully teamed up and still have, even though we're not as close collaboratively now because everything's, the wheels are all turning, we all produce graduates that are going to work at that Toyota plant and other plants and suppliers and other, you know, that supply Toyota. So that's something that we've done in Mississippi, and something we're currently doing is we started leaning in. We're neighbors to Mississippi State University, which is a very big ag and engineering university. And we started leaning in on them really hard and working with them. And that's starting to pay off. We've got grants for our college. One's in working with collaborative robots, which is robots and humans working together collaboratively. We're working with them on a composites grant. And we've got some aircraft manufacturers that build some really neat airplane parts that are very lightweight. So they kind of do the design and research, and we kind of help train the workers that'll end up working in the aircraft manufacturing facilities and build these parts. So we're really leaning more so on our university now to be a partner in the resources they bring than we are other community colleges.
Mm-hmm. Beth, what about Union College?
I can share an example from cybersecurity when I was there as a faculty member. I would go to various conferences, and I struck up a collegial relationship with a faculty member from Stevens Institute of Technology, which is maybe 45 minutes north of Union College. And she had some NSF money from Scholarship for Service, which they're looking to get more workers into the cybersecurity field. And they approached my colleague at Stevens and said, hey, we want to do a pilot to see if community college students could benefit from SFS money, Scholarship for Service money. So my colleague and I decided to embark on this journey together. And Union County identified two students to be part of this pilot program. And so they took the first 2 years of a cybersecurity degree program at Union County, and we made sure that the coursework transferred seamlessly to Stephen so that they would have junior status when they articulated. And they, both of the students that we sent, graduated within 4 years, and they had a full ride on SFF scholarship money. And then part of the SFF money is for every year that you take money, you have to give back to a government agency, whether it federal, state, tribal. So we have, that was a successful partnership for Union College.
Right. And I, and, you know, as we talk about this, what we hope that as the, our colleagues who joined us today, is that you think about the fact that you don't have to do this work alone. You can see a grant opportunity and you can call your neighboring community college or four-year institution and see if there's an opportunity for a partnership there. You know, at Prince George's, and many ways, because of where we are located, we have the option of a number of institutions with whom to partner, including the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, University of Maryland, College Park, Howard University, Bowie State University, and then a number of businesses and industries that want to partner with the institution because they're looking to grow a specific workforce. So that, you know, if we think about our own National CyberWatch Center, which was a national program, its name, National CyberWatch Center, and we had more than 200 partners across the United States, business, industry, government partners, two-year, four-year institutions, as we thought about ways to develop curriculum, certifications, and the like for those who attended our institutions and wanted to leave with certification or an associate degree in the cybersecurity industry. But what we understood was that we could either be the institution that was that held the grant and we gave out subcontracts, or we could be a sub, receive a sub award as a partner in the grant. And all of you, I know, remember the TAC grants. Who doesn't remember the TAC grants, right? Where we not only had to partner across our in our state, but we also had to partner across states in order to meet the needs of that grant. And I know, I think we had a question that may have just popped up in the chat, Beth, and I don't know if we want to take that question now.
I think it's apropos to take that now. I'll be glad to read that. And, you know, we have a couple minutes left on the SIPPYcast, so why don't we take this question? So this is from Daniel Mayo from San Bernardino Valley College, California. And Daniel asks, any ideas about ways to start a partnership with local STEM industries to participate in grants? Scott might have some solutions on that.
Yeah, I think the best success I've seen over my career is, you know, when you're engaged in employment activity, they want to hire skilled people, and sometimes you may not have enough of them coming out of your programs, or you need a different program. And I think I had started a lineman program earlier in my career and had some great cooperative electric co-ops and some energy producers that really came to the table to help get that. And it was actually funded with an NSF ATE grant, by the way. So we had NSF ATE funding, and the industries put up some time, money, and resources and people to help us get that started. So I think just finding that common need that will benefit the company in starting a program at the college to help them, to get entry-level workers with the credentials they need. And that program is still going on, by the way. It's a great AAS degree program. We built credentials into the program. So it was a lot of classes that culminated into a short-term credential. So we built the whole degree around that, which was really an emerging theme back in the mid-2000s, early, 2005, 2006. And we built that whole program up through that manner. And it's a very successful program, producing line workers for lots of companies in Mississippi.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, with the NSF ATE grants, they are actually looking for institutions that have a regional need that fits the intent of the grant. And that is part of that, that there is a business industry partner with that. So, and what I found is that business and industries are more than happy to write letters of support for the grant. And they're also more than willing to be an actual part of the implementation of the grant, because they see themselves as the recipients of the success of those kinds of endeavors. And then I think that we have maybe one more question we'd like to ask, and then Beth will open it up for questions from our audience, if that's all right with everyone. We want to be cognizant of the time too. And how do we talk about, I think that this is important from where I sit, about culturally responsive pedagogical practices to historically marginalized students in STEM education. How important do we see that as across our institutions? And for those of you who've joined us, if you have some feelings about this, please feel free to put it in the chat.
But Tony, I'll say this in regard to that question. That's one of the things. I don't have those answers, but that's one of the benefits of joining something like Achieving the Dream. You know, we started out with their data coaches, and they came in and we really dug deep into our data. But now they've handed our project off to this very type of coach, somebody that is culturally responsive to pedagogical practices. And we're going to go in and really look at some of our teaching practices. So hopefully we can close these gaps that I talked about earlier in some of these, particularly these STEM areas. They're, you know, working with some experts that's done this before. And I think that's where we are in this process.
Exactly. And you know, what I've always thought about is, because there are some myths that exist out there with regard to students of color, what they can and cannot do. And while I think that those myths might be decreasing, they do exist nonetheless. And one of them actually is around mathematics. And you mentioned that earlier when you spoke, Scott, about the work that you all did at East Mississippi with regard to enhancing math skills. And you know, what I always think about is if we take the whole issue of math and apply it in other areas where students of color tend to be very good athletically, for instance. And, you know, when you think about basketball and the like, and you think about the physics, you know, what LeBron James does every time he gets on the court, when he shoots a three-pointer from half court, you know, the physics is involved in that. You know, how do you know about the arc of the ball and you know, where you need to stand and how you need to face, and, you know, how you need to be facing the basket and the like. So that tells you that I've been watching the playoffs, in case you all didn't get that message here. But, you know, I think that there are a number of things that, and we've talked a lot over probably more than 10, 15, 20 years about how faculty and those of us who serve students learn to understand what it means to be culturally responsive. And more importantly, what does it mean not to label students or stereotype students when they come into our institutions and organizations. And I think that some of what we're doing with this program, and certainly what the National Science Foundation is doing, even as it continues, the federal government continues its commitment to equity and diversity and inclusion and the like, that it behooves us as the nation's community colleges to be able to stand up and talk about the things that we've done in order to ensure that all students are successful, no matter their background, their income, their zip code. So with that, Beth, maybe I'll turn it to you, and we'll see if there are questions from our participants. And I think at some point, if you have a question, we'll ask you to use the raise hand feature. We'll try to follow it. Or if you put it in the chat, we'll actually call on you to ask your question. And you can direct it to any one of us or all of us.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Dukes. Yeah, we have a couple questions, and we actually have an answer also in the chat. So Cheryl Schreiber from my former institution, she's a grants writer there. She asks, are there grants community colleges should be looking at in addition to NSF ATE and IUs? And Joe Little responded to Cheryl saying, one additional program we are exploring with the NSF is the NSF Innovations in Two-Year College STEM Education, ITYC program. So are there any other suggestions out there for Cheryl? I know, Dr. Yes. Dukes, you mentioned the consortium grant, right? So if you can get some partners together. And I see that Dr. Tellis has her hands up and can and chime in on that response.
The NSF STEM program, which is a scholarships in STEM, is an excellent program. 60% has to go to scholarships, but the other 40% can be used for a wide variety of things. And they have three tracks. One is for partnership kinds of things. One is single institutions. And one is kind of a beginning program for ones that haven't had one of these kinds of awards. So I would encourage you to look at the STEM program too.
Thank you. And we have another response helping you out there, Cheryl, from Ed Leach. And he said, NSF granted program, it might be of some interest. And he put the link to that in the chat. So granted, all capital.
Absolutely. You know, while we are predominantly very much focused on National Science Foundation and ATE, there are a number of programs within NSF where community colleges do have the ability to apply and always to benefit from. And then there are grant programs across the federal government that also deal with STEM. When, you know, we think about commerce and labor, I know a number of community colleges are now partnering with grants with business industry around electric vehicles. And then, Scott, you mentioned agriculture. And quite frankly, when you think about the science of agriculture, the Department of Agriculture is looking because they do want to bring back, you know, farming in America and do it in such a way that it does rely on science and technology, engineering, and the like. So you can look across a plethora of federal programs and that also have state programs that are similar in that way.
Dr. Tellis?
Yeah. Yeah. I'd just like to mention one other thing is, there are several programs that are funded now to teach you how to bring industry in. And one is the Pathways to Innovation. And we can probably find a link and share that at some point with you. That's out of one of the centers. And there's one at ATE Central that has an online workshop this spring to try to teach faculty how to start doing these collaborative things with industry. And then I would encourage you, if you have some particular areas, to find an ATE center that focuses on that and go to some of their workshops and just make some connections with some of those projects. And you mentioned electric vehicles. There is several ATE regional and centers in electric vehicles and other alternatives. And so sometimes just getting involved with somebody else and they're looking for partners, and that might be a good way to involve yourself with some of these.
Sure. And then what I will say is I know that our time is drawing near and we don't want to keep you longer than we had promised, and we've already done that. But I do want to acknowledge at least who I see on the screen, Dr. Sylvia Jenkins, President Emerita of Moraine Valley Community College out of Illinois, is a member of our National Advisory Board. I see Dr. Dan Phelan, who is a regional network chair and the like. And I know we've already indicated that we have a number of our regional coordinators who are on the call with us today. But want to thank you all. And we do have a last minute thing that we'd like to ask you to do. Even as we say to you, if you have any questions for us, go to our website. You'll see the presentation, but you'll also be able to send us any questions and we'll respond to you. So this is the poll. Beth, you want to talk about the poll for us?
Yeah, thank you. So the poll has some open-ended questions and closed-ended questions. So we appreciate any feedback that you can give us on any of the questions. It helps us improve our SIPPYcast.
Right. So we'll give you a few moments to start responding to the poll. And then if there are any last minute questions or comments, please don't hesitate to raise your hand or come off mute. But we don't want you to leave until you finish the poll.
We have 10%, 11%. So they're flowing in here.
Thank you for that. So
I see,
go ahead.
There's a very active conversation going in chat, and people are sharing resources, what grants you can go for. And Blake Urbach, who is also part of the SIPI STEM project, she's our external evaluator. She put in NSFI test. So that's another resource for you all.
And these are all great. Well, we when we put the presentation out, will we indicate any of this information that's in the poll or in the chat? Or we're asking you to make sure you go to the chat and see what's out there and make a note of it for yourself.
What we could do, Dr. Dukes, is I will get a copy of the chat. And what I can do is make a summary document and post that along with the slides for all those resources that were mentioned. So I'll be glad to do that.
Okay. So we have
62%
right.
Participated, 66.
Dr. Hartman and I are eagle eyes on this poll.
Yeah. Blake, this is Blake's data. We call it Blake's data because she interprets it for us and says, hey, you might want to tweak the guitar string a little bit this way for you. Mm-hmm.
I see we also have, I finally see her picture, Dr. Jennifer Wimbush, who is one of our RN chairs. I saw Ms. June Fordham, who is our regional coordinator. So she coordinates all the coordinators. So want to thank you all for joining too. So you have a number of our, what we call our SIPI STEM leadership team on the call.
Dr. Dukes, we're 82%. That's great.
Okay. And Ms. Armstrong, we're going to make sure that you have access to the PowerPoint. It'll be up on our website. And we also have a number of resources on the website. The mentoring programs that we spoke about, the information about that is on our website as well. We have a number of articles. And not only will the PDFs that we mentioned during this presentation be in the PowerPoint, we'll also put them up on the list of resources that we've been gathering and updating weekly in some cases, since this grant has begun.
Okay, I closed the poll and I shared the results. So you should be able to see the results. If I share my screen, I can share those results with everyone here. So the first question, were we knowledgeable? So it looks like most people thought we were knowledgeable. So that's good. The speakers were knowledgeable. Tend to share the resources. Looks like a lot of folks are going 73% want to share the resources. Well, if you add the 20%, then that's 93%. Can I apply what I learned from this webcast? We have a lot of positives on that as well. I would recommend the recording to a colleague. Looks like people would do that. And was it on par with my expectations? Looks like that also was okay. And what are your top two takeaways, and we'll, Blake, you're going to have to read those and let us know. But we do have people who answered those as well. Okay. So with that, Dr. Dukes, would you like to close us out and wish us happy holidays and all the good jazz?
Absolutely. Want to thank you all for being with us. Please stay tuned. We do announce our webinars on our site. The other thing is that for those of you who are new to SIPI STEM, not to worry, because we've captured your email addresses and you will get information from us about upcoming webinars fairly regularly. Want to thank Scott also Brooks, who quite frankly has become a great friend. He doesn't know that yet, but he agreed at the last moment to come on with us, and he rearranged his calendar to make that happen. So you know how important this work is to him and East Mississippi Community College. And always want to thank Dr. Elizabeth Hawthorne, who we affectionately call Beth. She is our moderator. And today we said to her, no, you're going to be part of the conversation and the dialogue. And to thank all of you who gave now about 60 minutes of your time. We know how precious it is as you continue to serve the millions of students who call the nation's community colleges home. Thanks for being with us. Take care. Have a great holiday. Enjoy the winter break. Rest, relax, and refresh. Take care. And again, thank you for being on.